You know, there is a black sign under the nail, and it doesn't mean that it can be removed. It is, the blood is there, and the blood is all over, you know, maybe inside the veins running, moving. It doesn't mean you have to get rid of it. So, of course, you in that case, you don't have to do anything. But if it is still clearly recognized as blood, then it is impure. And in this case, of course, if water can reach it without undue hardship, the blood must be drained. And the area must be purified before wudu or ghusl. But sometimes it's kind of difficult to remove because it's trapped under the nail. And there's nothing you can do.
Yes.
This is blood. But, of course, you are not supposed to get
do anything.
Otherwise, you will lead. You will have to go through through unbearable hardship.
Or medical operation.
Yep.
Very a slight one, but again, you have to go under the knife.
I said that if draining the blood might cause excessive difficulty or harm,
yes,
hardship, then one should wash the area around the nail carefully without spreading the impurity. And then His Eminence says that he should cover it with a cloth or plaster and wipe over it if it is, you know, there is a kind of maybe blood over it which cannot be removed. It might be difficult to remove. And so, but if it's under the nail, there's no need for it. It's trapped inside under the nail. And so, that's it.
Yes. Another quick question, just to wrap up our session. Are the important leather or leather products canonically impure or pure if we are uncertain as to whether they are derived from a properly slaughtered carcass?
Right. Of course, if it is certain or reasonably possible that the imported leather comes from an animal slaughtered according to Islamic law, then the leather is pure. If there is a strong chance or a greater possibility that the leather might have been from an animal slaughtered according to Islamic law, then the leather should be, or the product made of leather should be treated as pure. But if such possibility does not exist, for example, if it certainly comes from a non-halal source, of course the leather is considered impure and cannot be used in acts of worship that require purity, such as salat, such as the tawaf of hajj, and its prayers, and all these acts of worship which require the ritual purity.
And the leather should come from the skin of the halal animals.
Of course, the halal animal. But if even that halal animal is not slaughtered according to Islamic law, then it becomes a dead body.
Uh-huh.
A dead body slaughtered, which has not been slaughtered. A dead body is as impure as any other animal that is not halal to eat.
Thank you, Sheikh. That was Sheikh Javed talking with me, answering my Islamic laws related questions according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. That's it from me, Muhammad Javed, the host of this program. And the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
Irish Radio.
Have a very good time. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. In 10th century Cordoba, an Umayyad Islamic dynasty city in Spain with over 70 libraries, the palace library alone had over 60,000 volumes, all written by hand. At the time, the best Latin library in Europe had only 600 parchment books. While the Chinese invested paper sometime before the 2nd century BC, Muslims were the first to mass-produce paper on an intercontinental scale, developing a culture dependent on its abundance. As the price of paper dropped, literacy rose and booksellers and libraries became integral parts of every Muslim city. Like Judaism and Christianity, Islam originated in the Middle East. And here's what's awaiting you on your radio station. Don't miss a beat. Up next is Let's Recite the Holy Quran. Mr. Habibullah Fasih Zadeh will guide us. In this program, we teach eloquent recitation of the Quran at level 2. We also express tajweed points in the manner of confrontation or compare and match and apply them to the verses of the final surahs of the Holy Quran. A beautiful opportunity for reflection indeed. Then enjoy another segment from our radio productions. We've created a range of fascinating audio pieces for your listening pleasure. Coming up, we will have Let's Recite the Quran. Stay tuned.
Let's recite the Quran.
وَإِذَا قَرَأْتَ الْقُرْآنَ جَعَلْنَا بَيْنَكَ وَبَيْنَ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْآخِرَةِ حِجَابًا مَسْتُورًا
القرآن نور وبيان القرآن هدي الإيمان القرآن مسك الختام قرآن عليك سلام
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone, brothers and sisters, dear listeners all over the world, listening to Arab English Radio right now, welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Karim. Here today again with brothers Ali Nasir, Hassan, Hussein, and Masoom. I'm here with you. Inshallah, today we will be practicing verse number 33, ayah 33, Surah Ar-Ra'd, on page 253. Thank you so much for telling us the page. Brothers and sisters, hope you have the Quran. Turn to page 253, Surah Ar-Ra'd, verse number 33.
All right?
Yes. Let's go.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم أفمن هو قائم على كل نفس بما كسبت وجعلوا لله شركاء قل سموهم أم تنبئونه بما لا يعلم في الأرض أم بظاهر من القول بل زين للذين كفروا مكرهم وصدوا عن السبيل ومن يضلل الله فما له من هاد
Then is he who is a maintainer of every soul, knowing what it has earned, like any other? But to Allah they have attributed partners. Say, name them. Or do you inform him of that which he knows not upon the earth, or of what is apparent of speech? Rather, their own plan has been made attractive to those who disbelieve, and they have been averted from the way. And whomever Allah leaves astray, there will be for him no guide.
That was a very nice recitation. May Allah bless the reciter, insha'Allah. Let's go and take a look at this ayah, what Allah Almighty says, and let's learn something from this ayah, insha'Allah. Actually, we'll be mentioning short points. I want you to refer to the tafsir books, insha'Allah, to learn the detailed explanation, all right?
Yes.
All right, the full interpretation of this ayah. So, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Allah Almighty says in Ayah 33, Surah Al-Ra'd, on page 253, that أَفَمَنْ هُوَ قَائِمٌ عَلَى كُلِّ نَفْسٍ بِمَا كَسَبَتْ وَجَعَلُوا لِلَّهِ شُرَكَاءَ قُلْ سَمُّوهُمْ. So, Allah Almighty says, is he, Allah, who sustains every soul, in spite of what it earns, comparable, is he comparable to the idols, God forbid? And yet they ascribe partners to Allah. Say, name them. قُلْ سَمُّوهُمْ أَمْ تُنَبِّئُونَهُ بِمَا لَا يَعْلَمُ فِي الْأَرْضِ أَمْ بِظَاهِرٍ مِّنَ الْقَوْلِ. Will you inform him of something he does not know about on the earth, or of what are mere words? بَلْ rather, زُيِّنَ لِلَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مَكْرُهُمْ وَصُدُّوا عَنِ السَّبِيلِ. Their scheming is presented as decorous to the faithless, and they have been barred from the right way. وَمَنْ يُضْلِلِ اللَّهُ, this is very, very, like, important lesson. وَمَنْ يُضْلِلِ اللَّهُ فَمَا لَهُ مِنْ هَادِ. Guys, and whomever Allah leads astray has no guide. I want to explain more about this. You refer to the tafsir books. Hussein, would you please recite this ayah once for us? Let's see what important tajweed points we have to review here. Too many tajweed points, but the most important ones we'll be explaining. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Guys?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Hussein, would you please once recite this ayah?
Yes. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أفمن هو قائم على كل نفس بما كسبت.
Wait. كل. Does the letter lam have tanween?
No.
No.
كل نفس.
كل نفس. Repeat it.
أفمن هو قائم على كل نفس بما كسبت.
أحسنتم. أحسنتم. See. أَفَمَنْ هُوَ قَاءٌ. The letter قَاف, it has a heavy sound. Make sure you pronounce it with an A sound. قَاء, not قَاء. قَائِمٌ. There is a mad with the letter قَاف, yes? Letter قَاف with the alif mad.
Yes.
And there is a mad on the top. So this tells you that this mad is?
واجب.
واجب. You have to extend it. أَفَمَنْ هُوَ قَائِمٌ, right? عَلَى كُلِّ نَفْسٍ بِمَا. نَفْسٍ بِمَا. Do you see that tiny meme below the letter sin?
Yes.
With a kasra. That kasra and meme is the sign, actually, it tells you that this is tanween. Yes, tanween kasra, followed by the letter ba. That's why that meme is there. It tells you that this tanween sound, nafsin n sound, should be changed to a
hidden meme sound.
Hidden meme sound. How would you recite it, Ali Nasir?
Kulli nafsin bima.
Nafsin bima. Nafsin. Nafsin. but hide it. Pronounce it hiddenly. Nafsiyun bima. Super easy. Bima kasabat. But do not say kasabat. I didn't hear the ta. But if you also say kasabat, it's too much on ta. So kasabat.
Yes. Right?
The soft one. So Hassan, tell us about that qila. Why did he stop here?
Because qila says it's better to stop.
Better to stop. He could continue, yes? It was correct, yeah?
Can, yes.
All right.
How to learn Quran easy? What is the correct way to read the Quran? What is the correct way to learn Arabic and understand the Quran? Be with, let's recite the Quran.
Move on. Say.
وَجَعَلُوا لِلَّهِ شُرَكَاءَ قُلْ سَمُّوهُمْ
أَحْسَنْتُمْ. شُرَكَاءَ also has got a mad. The mad is wajib to be extended. You have to stretch it, all right?
Yes.
شُرَكَاءَ قُلْ سَمُّوهُمْ سَمْمْ مِمْ وَتْشَدَّ, right? Extend the sound. Jim indicates what?
Jim allows us to make a pause.
Allows you to make a pause. So it allowed Hussein to make a pause here, and that's why he did. Move on.
Am tunabbi'unahu.
Read it again. Why did you hide the sound of me? Pronounce it clearly. Am tunabbi'unahu. Right?
Yes.
أَمْ تُنَبِّئُونَهُ بِمَا لَا يَعْلَمُ فِي الْأَرْضِ أَمْ بِظَاهِرٍ مِّنَ الْقَوْلِ
أحسنتم. This one, this one is hidden. Okay,
yes.
I have to pronounce it. Why? Because the letter ميم is ساكن. And ميم ساكنة followed by the letter
ba.
Ba. You have to hide the sound. Not by the letter, followed by the letter ta. Like أَمْ تُنَبِّئُونَهُ. That's أَمْ تُنَبِّئُونَهُ. But this one is أَمْ بِظَاهِرٍ. Alright?
Yes.
Very easy, mashallah. أَمْ بِظَاهِرٍ followed by ميم. ظَاهِرٍ. Merge them. إِدْغَام. مِنَ الْقَوْلِ. So, yeah, that's قِلَة. We talked about it. Move on.
بَلْ زُيِّنَ لِلَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مَكْرُهُمْ وَصُدُّوا عَنِ السَّبِيلِ
أحسنتم. Not very, like, challenging tajweed rules. Move on.
وَمَنْ يُضْلِلِ اللَّهُ فَمَا لَهُ مِنْ هَادٍ
أحسنتم. وَمَنْ يُضْلِلِ. How do you say that?
وَمَنْ
يُضْلِلِ. Noon is omitted. Meme is merged to that. Ya and ya is doubled, okay?
Yes.
And you extend the sound also with a nasal sound. Okay. That's it. فَمَا لَهُ مِنْ هَا د. Echo the sound. I will recite this ayah once. Let's try it. Repeat after me, everyone. Let's practice it, okay? Ready?
Yes.
أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
أفمن هو قائم على كل نفس بما كسبت
أَفَمَنْ هُوَ قَائِمٌ عَلَى كُلِّ نفس بما كسبت
وجعلوا لله شركاء قل سموهم
وجعلوا لله شركاء قل سموهم
أم تنبئونه بما لا يعلم في الأرض أم بظاهر من القول
أم تنبئونه بما لا يعلم في الأرض أم بظاهر من القول
بل زين للذين كفروا مكرهم وصدوا عن السبيل
بل زين للذين كفروا مكرهم وصدوا عن السبيل
ومن يضلل الله فما له من هاد
ومن يضلل الله فما له من هاد
صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم
أحسنتم. Thank you so much everyone. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, thank you so much for being with us. Allah bless you inshallah. That's it from us for today. Stay with Arab English Radio. We'll be here with you next session. Hassan Hussein Ali Nasser and Muhammad Masum. Thank you so much. Allah bless you. See you next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadi wa alihi at-tahirin.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعجل فرجه
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
صفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان Thank you.
concept of a greater Israel. A vague plan that Zionist theorists have been proposing for over a century, and following the formation of the Zionist regime in the 1940s, its leaders actively pursued the fulfillment of this plan through shedding the blood of thousands of innocent people in West Asia every year.
This is the Middle East, and this is the entire Arab world, and this is Israel. It's one of the world's tiniest countries. I give it the thumb test. This is a big one, so you need a bigger thumb. But it's a tiny country. It's one of the tiniest countries on the planet.
A plan that Benjamin Netanyahu, regarded as the most radical prime minister in the history of Israel, proudly showcases to the world.
But what I'm saying is, I believe eventually our borders will extend from Lebanon to the Great Desert, which is Saudi Arabia, and then from the Mediterranean to the Euphrates. And who's on the other side of the Euphrates? The Kurds. And the Kurds are our friends. So we have the Mediterranean behind us, the Kurds in front of us, Lebanon, which really needs the umbrella of protection of Israel. And then we're going to take Mecca, Medina, and Mount Sinai and purify those places.
Now, the instability in Syria, particularly following the fall of Bashar al-Assad's government and potential divisions in the country, has given rise to hopes within the Israeli regime, in particular for Netanyahu, to finally realize the dream of greater Israel. When, after almost 5 years of ceasefire, the armed opposition's operation in northern Syria began in western Aleppo on November 27, 2024, few people anticipated this operation would lead to the fall of Bashar al-Assad's government in the country.
Right now, I don't know for sure exactly whether the Sunni terrorists that comprise HTS have changed their spots. I don't really see I don't know their independence from Turkey. My guess would be that President Erdogan helped them.
But much to everyone's surprise, the pillars of the Syrian government quickly crumbled within 10 days in the 13th year of the crisis in the country, and forces led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group entered Damascus, the capital of Syria, from the north and south on December 8, 2024, marking the end of the Ba'ath Party's rule in Syria after 61 years. And Ahmed al-Sharra, also known as Abu Muhammad al-Julani, who had a history of involvement with terrorist groups such as Daesh and al-Nusra Front, later renamed Fatah al-Sham Front and Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, suddenly transformed from an international terrorist into the new ruler of Syria, replacing Bashar al-Assad.
I've been saying for well over a decade now that Syria is the dirtiest thing that we have ever done. I asked David Cameron 10 years ago, Daniel, if he'd read Frankenstein. And if he had read it, had he read it all the way to the end? The monster that Dr. Frankenstein created was out of control in the end because he's a monster. And that's exactly, surely, what we have done with Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
After Damascus fell and was captured by Jilani's forces, a power struggle ensued across Syria. In the northern and eastern suburbs of Aleppo, Turkish-backed groups attempted to leverage the situation to expand their territory and undermine the Kurdish militias associated with the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, which consists of the PYD and its military branches, the YPG and YPJ, and with the assistance and support of the U.S.-led coalition, they managed to seize substantial parts of eastern Syria under the pretext of combating the Daesh terrorist group. During the clashes between Kurdish militias and Turkish-backed groups, Jilani and his forces notably refrained from intervening militarily and maintained a neutral position, and in fact, they did not attack the forces supported by the U.S. Abu Muhammad al-Jilani has not only been a theorist and independent political figure, but also an actor who has implemented his own independent plans over the years and has changed roles successively based on the orders of Turkey or the CIA in the United States, coordinating his activities on Syrian soil with his main employers based on the needs of the time.
And America is back on the side of al-Qaeda, and because of the interests of a foreign power, and quite frankly, it's treason.
In his pursuit of dominating Damascus and becoming the main political and military force in Syria, Jilani and his entourage have made efforts to gain domestic and international legitimacy, which included extensive media operations to present a moderate and peace-loving image, as well as attempts to form a government more quickly and establish relations with international powers to gain their support.
There's been video of French-speaking jihadists parading through Latakia, an Alawite majority heavy region. People speaking like dozens of different languages. And Mohammed al-Jilani, the unelected leader of Syria's new junta, has said that he will make them all citizens. So there's a real crisis brewing. I think, you know, the amount of Western support that's going to come in for the al-Qaeda and Suud's administration might be strong enough to prevent it from tearing Syria apart, from tearing what's left of Syria apart. But it's a hideous picture. It's another mockery of the so-called rules-based order.
Yes.
But the new Jilani government faced two significant identity and geopolitical challenges as it sought to establish its power in Syria. The first involved the composition of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group, which its military commanders and political members consisted mainly of non-Syrian foreign forces or lacked significant political presence in Syria's history, and most importantly, they lacked the necessary popularity among the Syrian people, including those opposed to Bashar al-Assad. In fact, the cooperation of some individuals who opposed the Jilani regime or the silence of those who supported the former Syrian government may have been influenced by the military superiority and prevailing control of Jilani's organization during recent events.
You shouldn't be training, equipping jihadists. You shouldn't be training and equipping al-Qaeda and using them to form your governments. Exactly what we did in Libya, as you mentioned in your previous section. We did the exact same thing, and it tore the country apart. I find the timing very interesting, George, that it was in late December that Assad finally fell, was pushed. It's around the time that Israel was getting a real shellacking by Hezbollah in Lebanon and by Hamas in Gaza, despite the fact that they flattened the place, they were taking really unsustainable losses, and now you have an absolute chaos unleashed in Syria and a backlash where...
Although in the global media space, certain regional actors like Turkey are often portrayed as the primary supporters and orchestrators of the plan to overthrow the Syrian government and enable Jilani to seize power. However, the reality is that since the early stages of the Syrian conflict, the United States has been actively advancing and executing its own comprehensive plan to to sow instability in the country and bring about desired changes, utilizing its own mechanisms, such as Turkish intelligence agencies and terrorist groups operating within Syrian territory. In other words, even the most staunch opposition groups to the former Syrian government and the local people who supported them did not anticipate initially that a group with the slightest identity and ideals close to the Syrian revolution would emerge to assume power in Damascus on the day of victory and government overthrow.
So the whole, all of the concepts of state sovereignty and the UN Charter, which forbids everything that is happening to Syria, has been flipped upside down, and all we hear about is the joy of an authoritarian dictator being overthrown. But it's not, we're not seeing democracy replace him. We're seeing 1,000 dictators replace him.
But another major obstacle to establishing the Jolani government in Damascus as the governing body of a unified Syria was the fact the two regions in eastern and southern Syria remained outside the control of Jolani forces even after the fall of the former government. The eastern part of Syria, controlled by the Kurdish militias, and the Druze-majority city of Soweida in the south, which came under the control of the Druze armed groups following the fall of the former government. When the new Syrian government was formed, even though some ministers and officials from the former government were present, individuals close to or affiliated with the Kurdish groups in the east of the Euphrates and the dominant Druze in Soweida province did not participate, and this absence contributed to a lack of mutual trust between these parties and the Jolani government. This situation heightened Israel's long-standing concerns about the absence of a strong, unified government in Syria and the potential threat to Israel's security from Syria. The interim agreement signed by Jolani and Mazlum Abdi, the commander-in-chief of the Kurdish forces, was a temporary measure to ensure the direct non-militarization of both sides, and it appears the Kurdish militias east of the Euphrates are poised to support the implementation of the Israeli land corridor plan from the occupied territories to the Syrian Kurdistan region. The aspiration to connect this land corridor to oil and gas facilities and pipelines in eastern Syria and northern Iraq has been a long-standing goal for the Zionists aimed at ensuring energy security for a greater Israel. If envisioned as a two-step plan by the Zionists, the initial phase would involve establishing a strategic foothold in southern Syria and the Druze-majority region to facilitate the connection to the Kurdish area. Immediately after the confirmed fall of Bashar al-Assad's government, Israeli military forces conducted extensive attacks on remaining military infrastructure in Syria and encroached into Kenyatta province and parts of Reef Dimashq province, breaching the UN-approved agreement by crossing the ceasefire lines of 1974. Hundreds of Israeli Air Force bombings targeted Syrian air bases, ballistic missile launchers, depots, and the country's defense factory in areas such as Deir ez-Zor, Damascus, Palmyra, Aleppo, and Hama in order to significantly degrade the Syrian air, missile, and defense forces that had been developed over decades at great cost and were crucial for the country's defense security. At the same time, the Israeli military destroyed and transferred combat equipment for military bases in Kenyatta and Reef Dimashq, particularly in the highlands like Mount Hermon, and established monitoring bases in the southern Syrian border area. In recent years, Israel's attacks on the Syrian army and its military bases, coupled with engagement with Hezbollah in Lebanon, created conditions that facilitated the occupation of Damascus by Jolani and his forces. However, at the same time, Israel was concerned about certain armed groups of the Syrian opposition and has made efforts to prevent the formation of a strong government in Damascus by launching successive attacks and occupying new areas in southern Syria since the first day of the fall of Bashar al-Assad's government. Apart from this, Israel is currently experiencing a significant and prolonged water shortage crisis, and the Gormuk watershed, located near the occupied Golan Heights, holds crucial importance for Israel in terms of enhancing water security and geopolitical stability. Therefore, following the collapse of the previous Syrian government, the Israeli military prioritized targeting the dams and canals in the Syrian border area as they enter deep into Syria, and securing and monitoring these water-related infrastructures became a primary focus for the Israeli occupation military forces. The water from the upstream Golan Heights serves as a vital source for agricultural and drinking purposes in the occupied territories, and due to the ongoing political instability in Syria, Israel has been exploring new water sources in southern Syria to ensure the continued fulfillment of its water needs.
Yeah, there's a good point that, you know, these wars in the Middle East, as Wesley Clark pointed out, it's basically the neocon agenda, and a lot of these neocons are dual Israeli citizens, right? And so it's like, who has benefited? We were with Shimon Peres when he said, the Iraq war benefits us. You know, he said that during the, I remember very clearly, he's like, secures our border against Saddam, right, on the Iraq side. The wars are all, you know, as Jeffrey Sachs pointed out, this is all Israel's policy with the Middle East. It's almost like we've basically said, okay, whatever Israel wants in the Middle East, we'll do. Up and including the Syria thing, which I'm curious your position. But in the series, we get into this, how much, as we know, we supported creating these Al-Qaeda in Iraq and ISIS groups, right? Jihadists, which we did in Afghanistan, by the way, mm-hmm. in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done it in Libya against Gaddafi, which was insane, mm-hmm. right? And we did the same thing now with Syria, where, again, you know, another terrorist group is now in charge.
The plains between the provinces of Quneitra and Soweda are generally known as fertile agricultural areas, and if the potential of the Druze regions is utilized and efforts are made to unite Arab tribes of Dara, who have strained relations with Jolani and its forces and view them as foreign forces, Israel could significantly ensure a bountiful harvest of agricultural products from these fertile areas. The Kurdish militia forces are planning to move from the outskirts of Abu Kamal to the Al-Tanf base in the border triangle of Iraq, Syria, Jordan, and then connect with the province of Soweda and the Druze armed groups present there before finally reaching Israeli-controlled Golan Heights through the Druze towns south of Damascus, such as Jarmana, Sahneya, and Hadir.
You know, if this was happening in Ukraine and Russia was doing it, it would be all over the front pages as an invasion. Instead, we hear about Israel establishing a buffer zone. The State Department is defending Israel's invasion of Syria.
This plan, known as the Davis Corridor in political circles, has been the subject of media attention for several months.
Well, I mean, the partitioning plan for Syria, which of course was mentioned by John Kerry back in 2016 as being Plan B, is now swiftly becoming Plan A. And Syria, you know, with everything that's going on, is now also becoming the key focal point for the competition between Israeli expansionism and Turkish neo-Ottoman expansionism. Israel has recently put out a statement refusing HTS presence in the southern areas of Syria that Israel has now annexed and occupied, and effectively threatening HTS with military aggression should they infringe upon the Israeli-occupied territories south of Damascus.
If implemented, this plan would significantly weaken the ability of any government based in Damascus to manage the situation in Syria, both economically and politically, and will greatly increase Israel's influence in the country's internal affairs and West Asia, potentially marking a major step towards the formation of a greater Israel.
Saying this is in the Syrian Observer, Israel's strategic ambitions in Syria, fragmentation, balkanization, the David Corridor, and confrontation with Turkey. So as I said, Israel is now waking up to the fact that it does face competition over the control of Syria from Turkey and from Erdogan and his neo-Ottoman ambitions. This is effectively what is known as the David Corridor. So what Israel is going to attempt to do is to take control of the areas in the south and then basically extend the corridor up the eastern flank of Syria on the borders with Jordan and Iraq. And you'll see there also the Al-Tanf, the largest U.S. unlawful military base in Syria, could replace the U.S. military presence there with Israeli settlers.
The eastern regions of Syria, where the corridor is planned, contain main oil resources as well as the country's major grain fields, and the creation of such a corridor would open up an important economic route for the Kurds, who are currently facing serious problems due to the closure of the official border with Turkey for trade and exchange with other regional and global players. On the other hand, if this plan is implemented, it could lead to the Suwayda region overcoming its current economic and political isolation, making it more appealing for potential alliance between the Kurds and Druze with the Israeli leadership.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio. Let's quickly navigate what's coming up next. We're excited to present these programs, so please stay with us. Time to delve into economic divide. If you are interested in economic or business issues, then this program is definitely for you. top experts on the economy give expert analysis and commentary on the biggest business and economic stories of the day. Mind-provoking insights into the economic issues. Then it's time to listen to Spring of Truth. This program features English translations of selected powerful statements and speeches from the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. What's next up? We are featuring a collection of our finest radio productions. These are specially curated segments designed to entertain, educate, and inform you, dear listeners. So keep us company. Up next is Economic Divide.
Economic Divide.
The U.S. is still grappling on how to deal with China. It has imposed tariffs to slow down its economy and to bring back manufacturing to the U.S., but has failed to materialize. Instead of following its own advice, which is to work with the Chinese and see competition as a positive thing, it is doing its best to prevent China from advancing, especially economically. The U.S. has just missed out on a chunk of soybean sales to China that would have brought in billions of dollars to American manufacturers. Add to that, other sectors which are suffering and getting crushed by U.S. tariffs to China. The U.S. economy and its consumers are hurting more than ever before. Coming up in today's program, U.S. manufacturers hurting. Trump's tariffs are hurting American manufacturers and workers. Trump is not offering a real strategy to create jobs and for the economy to grow. Just continuous chaos. U.S. agriculture consumers suffering. Chinese crushers are buying Brazilian beans amid U.S.-China trade war, with the Chicago soybean futures near five-year lows amid trade uncertainty. China dumps the dollar. In the midst of it all, China is ditching the dollar fast, with China's leaders thinking a globally accepted yuan can insulate their exporters from movements in the dollar's value. We're going to be discussing those points and a whole lot more with Dr. Yang Jing, Assistant Director and Research Fellow of the Guang Institute of the GBA, and also Diane Sir, political analyst and former independent candidate for U.S. Senate.
Thank you for inviting me in this program. The trade war has no real winners. So historically, the U.S. and China have maintained very strong ties in trade, especially in the agricultural products. The U.S. has advanced agriculture technology and large-scale production capabilities, while China has a massive market demand. Nearly 60% of U.S. soybean production used to be exported to China. Even during the periods of tensions in the U.S.-China relations, the agriculture trade had often remained relatively stable. After Trump applied extreme pressures on China, his rational countermeasures for Chinese government to adjust its soybean import structure and shift to Brazil. The goal is to push the U.S. side to reconsider its policies so at the core, the U.S. agriculture state is their people, and even the state governments themselves don't want a tariff war, and China doesn't want it either. It's really only the Trump administration that pushing for a tariff or a trade. When U.S. soybean export struggle, the agriculture business might pass on the cost by raising the domestic price, which ultimately hurt its consumers. And the government could also roll out a massive subsidies to the farm states, but that's funded by the taxpayer also, who are also the consumers. So in the end, the people in the United States don't benefit from the trade wars. Only a few American politicians gain their personal advantages.
U.S. farmers are missing out on billions of dollars of soybean sales to China halfway through their prime marketing season. Chinese importers have booked around 7.4 million metric tons of mainly South American soybeans for October shipment, covering 95% of China's projected demand for the month and 1 million tons of for November, or about 15% of expected imports.
Globalization process deaccelerated during the Trump's era. It's not just China doing this, many countries are actually involved in it. But is China really ditching the dollar rapidly? From what I see now, there is not sufficient evidence for that yet. Different countries approach de-dollarization in their own ways. For example, countries like Russia or other countries hit by the Western sanctions tend to move faster, but their options are limited due to those sanctions. China, on the other hand, is taking a proactive, systematic approach, especially by boosting the RMB international status. And then there are also some pragmatic countries like India, Turkey, which handle it flexibility, say that by promoting the local currency, the settlements in the financial